The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times, the News and Observer, and the Washington Post. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to meet people who have found ways to enjoy travel as a sport. First up, we meet the woman who helped set a speed record on a classic alpine ski route. This is a question and answer article written by Paige McClanahan, and it appeared in the January 5th, 2022 issue of the New York Times. And it begins with the caption of the young lady in question, and that is Valentine Fabre and her ski mountaineering partner, Hilary Girardi. And they took on the Haute Route, traversing 66 miles of glaciers and passes in less than 27 hours. And the challenge they had? Finding confidence. Now the article. Valentine Fabre has no reason to doubt her abilities in the mountains. The 45-year-old Frenchwoman helped her country earn two world championships in ski mountaineering, a high-adrenaline endurance sport that involves sprinting up and racing down mountains on skis. She's also a military-trained doctor with a focus on high mountain medicine and a resident of the French Alps for 20 years. But when Dr. Fabre first started to consider her most recent challenge, she really wasn't sure she could do it. Her goal was to set a women's speed record on one of the most storied multi-day ski routes in the Alps, the Haute Route, which winds up and down more than 26,000 feet of mountainous landscape and across more than 65 miles of glaciers and remote alpine passes to connect Chamonix, where Dr. Fabre lives, to Zermatt in neighboring Switzerland. It's a route that has a special meaning for Dr. Fabre, beyond its near-mythic status among mountaineers. In 2010, her husband, Laurent Fabre, was part of the team that set a new men's speed record on the Haute Route, completing the itinerary, which takes most experienced skiers 6 to 7 days to do in just 28 minutes. 2 years later, Mr. Fabre, who worked as a high mountain guide, died in a climbing accident outside of Chamonix. Dr. Fabre was on call at the hospital when she got the news. Last April, that's 2021, almost 9 years after her husband's death, Dr. Fabre, alongside her American teammate, Hilary Girardi, established a women's speed record on the Haute Route with a time of 26 hours and 21 minutes. Dr. Fabre credits Ms. Girardi's enthusiasm for giving her the push she needed to take on the challenge, which was documented in a 34-minute film released in September 2021. I reached Dr. Fabre at her home in Chamonix a few weeks before Christmas, and she described what it felt like to set the record, why she hoped someone will break it soon, and how even though she grew up near Paris, she always knew she would make her home in the mountains. And this conversation was edited for length and clarity, and it is done in a question and answer format. I'll read the question first. What is the Haute Route, and what does it represent in the world of mountaineering? And her answer, it's a ski route that connects the two capitals of French and Swiss mountaineering, Chamonix and Zermatt, going through the high mountains and over glaciers. The itinerary we took was 107 kilometers long, that's about 66 miles, with 8,100 meters, or 26,500 feet, of positive elevation gain. There are several variations, but we took the pretty classic high route. Back in the 19th century, I think it was a big challenge. People wanted to connect these two cities, which they first did by foot, groping their way through the valleys and looking for the best way. The route was done on skis for the first time in 1903, and I'm lucky enough to have had access to the photo album that documents the first expedition. They managed to bring along a camera that weighed nearly 42 pounds, and they took some incredible photos. I think it took them about 2 or 3 weeks. Question, what was your first experience on the Haute Route? Answer, I first did it in 2000 when I was a medical student, and again in 2002 with my husband, Loren, though he wasn't my husband yet. We did it in the opposite direction that time, Zermatt to Chamonix, and we got to know each other along the way. I was doing an internship as a doctor with the Army at the time, and we met when he was a high mountain guide for the Army. Question: when did you first get the idea that you wanted to try to set a women's speed record on the route? Answer: my husband first tried to set the men's record in 2008, but he was exhausted and had to stop. Then in 2009, the weather was very bad and the whole team quit. In 2010, they finally set the record. I was an assistant on each of those attempts. I wanted to do it, but I didn't necessarily think I had the skills because for me, those guys were heroes. They were very, very strong, and they were men. No woman had done that. It was after Loren's death that I really formulated this desire to do something for his in his memory, and I knew that setting a record on the haute route would be the most beautiful tribute I could do for him. But I doubted my ability to achieve it, so time passed, and I didn't go for it. But then, finally, I got the spark I needed when I started training with Hillary. Question: so how did you and Miss Girardi team up? Answer: it was February or March 2019. We both did a 1,000-meter vertical ski race. Hillary won, and I came in second. We were waiting for the award ceremony after the race, and my partner Ben heard her talking about how she wanted to set a record on the Chamonix-Zermatt route. Ben knew that I had this idea, but that I doubted my abilities, so he told me, "That's exactly the person you need to make a great team." Hillary is about 10 years younger than me, and I think that age difference means she doesn't doubt her abilities the way I do. Now, I see women half my age who really believe that women can make a mark and set their own records. There's a cultural difference, too. Americans have a very positive character, always saying, "That's amazing, good job." While we French are more like, "Okay, you could have done that better." Hillary is a trail runner, so she has great endurance. She's also very versatile in the mountains, very positive, and very determined. Once I get into it, I'm determined too, but I hesitate to start, so I don't know if I would ever set this record if I hadn't met her. Question: you set the women's record on the route in April 2021. How did the day go? Answer: we left from the church in Chamonix at 2 p.m., and we arrived at the church in Zermatt at 4:21 p.m. the next day, which was Easter Sunday. There wasn't a big crowd waiting, just a few family and friends. The snow conditions had deteriorated a bit over the previous week, so we were a little doubtful that we would make it, which is why we hadn't alerted too many people. When we arrived in Zermatt, no one was really interested in these two exhausted women who were crying their eyes out and throwing themselves into the arms of the few people who were waiting. Question: and what did it feel like to make it to Zermatt? Answer: it was kind of a volcano of emotions. I was exhausted and so relieved to have finished. I was also very moved because I realized that I had done it. I had made the tribute to my husband. I had done as he had done. I had succeeded in connecting Chamonix to Zermatt on my skis and without assistance. So there was a personal pride and also powerful thoughts of Loren. Just after his death, I had the impression that he was with me everywhere, that he was watching over me. It's thanks to him that I'm doing this sport. Question: you live in Chamonix now, but you didn't grow up in the Alps. What drew you to that part of France? Answer: until the age of 17, I lived in the area around Paris, but as a child, I always wanted to live in the mountains. When I was 10, I had a cousin who got married in Chamonix, and while we were there, my father and I took the lift up to the Aiguille du Midi, and I was just amazed and thought, how would I love to live there? Later, when I was a medical student in Bordeaux, I made a lot of trips to the Pyrenees, and then I did an internship in Chamonix in 2001 and 2002, when I met Loren later. Later, I was able to do some mountain diplomas, which allowed me to get a position accompanying the mountaineers of the military high mountain group. Living in the mountains has always been something inside me, and the training it has allowed me to come here and stay. Question: you just finished your active service with the military. Will you still work as a doctor or turn your attention more fully to the mountains? Answer: I'm going to try to do both, continue to work as a doctor, doing shifts in the emergency department and as a reservist for the military, while also pursuing projects in the mountains. It's important to me to have both these lines of work, which challenge me in different ways. Being in the mountains requires a lot of intellectual ability, calculating risk, preparing your body, all of that. But, of course, being a doctor is also very intellectual. You have to really consider a diagnosis, make your investigation. It's also fatiguing in its own way, But for me, both of these activities are really important. Answer, have you heard of any other women who are trying to break your record on the auto route? Answer, so far I haven't heard anyone say that they were interested, but we would be happy if other women came to us. Because it's not just about keeping the record to ourselves for as long as possible. It's about inspiring others and helping them achieve it. That's what I didn't have. And by the way, writer and interviewer Paige McClanahan hosts a podcast called the Better Travel Podcast. So you might want to Google that and listen to that sometime. Well, our next traveler also uses skis to find joy on the trails. This article, headlined Be Persistent, originally was written by Tony Kennedy for the Minneapolis Star Tribune and appeared in the January 10, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. Now, a photo caption provides an overview of what we're going to be reading. Odd Island skis 4 to 5 times per week at Terrace Oak Parks in Burnsville, Minnesota. Oslin, age 81, is an elite amateur cross-country skier. Dateline, Minneapolis. 70 years ago in the coastal mountains of Norway near the town of Sonnes, kids would gather on Sunday afternoon in March and April to ski to a peak overlooking the North Sea. Once there, they could rest on bare rocks and soak up the sun, free from farm chores and with the darkest days of winter behind them. Best of all, they would rather return to class Monday morning with suntans. That was the thing, said Odd Island, an elite amateur cross-country skier who has lived in Minnesota for almost 50 years now. At 81, he, retired manufacturing engineer, continues to impress others with his trademark kindness and relentless skiing. Again this winter, he is returning to the starting lines of races in the United States, Canada, and Europe. With amazing consistency, he wins. Medals and trophies from his races in his age group dominate the kitchen in his Apple Valley town home. Last winter, for instance, he returned with 4 medals from the Masters World Cup Cross Country Skiing Championships in Kenmore, Alberta. In March, he'll travel to Zwiefel, Austria for the same event. In January, he'll compete in the Sigue Ski Fest in Ironwood, Michigan. In Minnesota and Wisconsin, he treats as holy days the city of Lakes Lepet and the American Birkbeiner. I'll keep racing until I'm 90 and then reassess, Oslin says. That is his stock answer to a question he feels endlessly. Another common question he gets, how do you pronounce your first name? That's my American problem, he said. I usually tell people to say Odd. You can also say Odd, which is how it's spelled, by the way. But in Norway, it's pronounced just like it's spelled. Hence, he personalized Minnesota license plate declares, I'm Odd. He has a wry sense of humor. Inside the Twin Cities cross-country skiing community, Oslin is known for his more than longevity in racing and strict discipline in training. In a stack of papers on his kitchen table late last year, there was a handwritten note from someone at the Lepet Foundation. Odd, you are actually the greatest. Thank you for being a rock for the Lepet and the entire ski community. You are amazing. He has volunteered time and given money to the Lepet and outdoors-oriented community-building organization based in Golden Valley. For him, personal interaction is the lifeblood of skiing. After so many years, it becomes like a family, Oslin says. People are amazing. When given advice to new skiers of any age, he'll bypass talk about the addictive atmosphere around racing and the self-sacrifice required to win. His core teaching about the sport is to find joy in it. Be persistent and enjoy winter by being outside with your friends, he once wrote in a published essay. As we age, we face different challenges that may sideline us from time to time. Don't give up. Keep a positive attitude and remember how much fun it is to ski. Oslin grew up in the oldest of 6 children on a family farm about 30 miles south of Stavanger, a seaport. Since birth and still today, he has battled a rare bone disorder known as McCune-Albright syndrome. It caused lasting instability in his left femur, requiring him to wear a brace and to undergo surgeries when it broke. I was a weakling, he said of his youth. Looking back, that's probably what motivated me to take on the physical challenges of skiing. But that didn't happen until he settled in America. His 3 sisters and 2 brothers still live in Scandinavia, where brother Per Oslin teaches theoretical particles physics at the University of Bergen. Ode said he felt a calling to leave the country in his late 20s after listening to elders talk about friends and family members who struck it rich in the land of opportunity. His arrival in 1970 was in Cooperstown, North Dakota, a tiny community northwest of Fargo, where cousins offered him a job on their farm. A downturn in the family business left him looking for new work, eventually punching a clock at a North Dakota factory that made field plows. It was the start of a long career in manufacturing, including stops at a Minneapolis-based Greco and a stint making medical-grade compressors and vacuum pumps in Northbrook, Illinois. After 5 years in the greater Chicago area, Oslin returned to the Twin Cities with enough experience to work as a product designer and engineer. He won a job at 3M that lasted 25 years. He never obtained a college degree, but he took engineering classes along the way. "I had a good feel for what machinery could do and how to make it," he said. Ski racing for Oslin started in 1990 when he entered the first American Birkbeiner in Hayward, Wisconsin with friends. He got to know Bjorn Lasserud, an accomplished racer, and trained with him, for nearly 20 years. As a regular participant in the Lepet Nordic Racing, also called the LNR, training program, Oslin also raced on Lepet teams. Starting in 2008, he entered the first Masters World Cup race in McCall, Idaho. "I'm not the fastest skier in my age class in the world circuit, but fast enough that I'm usually picked to participate on the U.S. age class relay teams," he once said in a skiing interview. "I'm content with that, just being part of the excitement of competing and to be fit and like-minded people." Joanne Whitman, a close friend of Oslin, said it's difficult for him to dwell on specific skiing accomplishments. "You have to pull things out of him," she said. "He never says anything about himself." According to an old magazine clipping, Oslin finished first in his age class in the Birkbeiner in both 2012 and 2013, after placing second on three separate occasions. He said he likes to push himself and experience the result of it. One of his skiing heroes is Norwegian cross-country legend Odvar Brah, revered in his country for overcoming a broken ski pole during a sprint to the finish line at the 1982 World Championships in Oslo. Brah was also known as a man of the people, who pushed himself to such extremes during races that he would hallucinate. The point was not to endure the agony, he would say, but to enjoy it. Whitman sees a trace of that in Oslin, who has suffered frostbite on his face more than once during training runs. He'll say, "In a way, it's a good thing. Takes off some dead skin," she said. But Whitman and said Oslin, who has dual citizenship in the U.S. and Norway, also has a softer side. He's an amateur photographer who has won ribbons in local competitions and is renowned among friends for his bread-baking hobby. Cranberry wheat bread is one of his favorites. Oslin and ex-wife Carol raised four children. Tragedy struck their family in October 1997 when their only daughter Carrie died at age 16 in a car crash in Apple Valley. She was a cheerleader at Eastview High School. "She was my best friend," Oslin said. To stay fit during summers, Oslin rides his bike and works out on roller skis. He idolizes Olympian gold medalist Jessie Diggins of Afton and met her father on roller skiing training runs on the Gateway State Trail in Washington County. Formerly a regular on the cross-country trails at Theodore Worth Park in Minneapolis, he now bases his winter skiing at Highland Hills Ski Area in Bloomington and Terrace Oaks Park in Burnsville. He's in it for the long haul, even though his doctor recently ordered heart monitoring for episodes of atrial fibrillation. "I've noticed it, yes, and they will look at all that," Oslin said. "Basically, I think I'm okay." I'd say so. Wow. Well, we have to leave the ski trails to hear from another traveler who's going to tell us what it's like to live full-time on a 400-square-foot sailboat. As writer Dan Parsons explains, living on a boat has a way of shifting your perspective, say those who do it, by freeing you from excess stuff and forcing you to exist in the moment. Dan's article appeared in the December 15, 2022, issue of the Washington Post, and we're going to start with the photo caption that says here, "Living on a boat has a way of shifting perspective," as he writes. Then he goes on, "Dan Parsons, author of this story, with his wife Perry Cooper and their dog Rackham, in the small but fully outfitted cabin of their sailboat, the Pelican." So there you got this picture of this boat called the Pelican, and it's small. "Bruises are unavoidable when you live on a sailboat. You get banged around using the bathroom, cooking dinner, feeding the dog, and then you struggle to put each contusion together with a specific incident. Where did this one come from? Like this one on my shin, or there's often no telling. Ballet is required to live in and around 400 square feet. My boat pelican measures 40 feet from stem to stern and 12 feet at its widest. My wife, Perry, and I lived aboard it full-time for 6 months during the height of the coronavirus pandemic before buying a house in New Bern, North Carolina. Along the way, we met various other people who'd also opted for floating life. Like us, they found that the benefits of making a sailboat your home often outweigh the sacrifices of space, possessions, and small comforts like long showers. Plus, much of what sailing teaches you is just as applicable on land. How to make a small space feel happier, according to the mental health pros. When I moved aboard Obelix, I had one bag, says Mads Dalken, a former IT professional from Denmark who now sails full-time on his first boat. That was scary to downsize to that extent, but it was also a very liberating feeling. A large-scale balancing act. Unlike a van or a tiny house, a sailboat moves almost constantly. While also under sail, the vessel can heel, meaning lean, for hours at a time, and sometimes violently surge in one direction or the other. Everything in the galley is designed not to fall on the floor. Even so, my wife and I have had whole pots of coffee slide off the stove. As your house serves as your transportation as well as your protection from the wild sea around you, Steve Audette, who lives aboard a 45-foot sailboat named the Angelfish with his wife Karen, likens it to camping. You're in the elements and attempting to carry as little as possible while ensuring everything you need is close at hand. Living on a boat is a large-scale balancing act, he says. The confines of a sailboat have a way of showing you how little you actually need to be content. Seats and bunks overlay lockers where food and tools are kept. Many sailors tuck away canned goods and bottles of wine beneath the cabin floor. Balancing what you take to sea requires a lot of editing, since there is no room for extraneous items that tend to sit unused in closets and basements on land. Heath Phillips, who has lived aboard boats for years, his current home is the Valera, a 35-foot 1967 Aalborg, which is a spacious compared to the first vessel, a 25-foot Catalina. I've always liked the idea of living on a small space that were a little unusual, he says. I find that living on a boat really makes me feel like a kid in some ways, almost like Peter Pan or Tom Sawyer. It is my home and also my gateway to adventures. Phillips keeps three pairs of shoes, deck boots, flip-flops, and sneakers, and two drawers worth of clothing. Even your clothes have to serve multiple purposes, he says. Possessions are a funny thing on board. I thought the only plan was buying a house, having a mortgage. Dalke, the sailor from Denmark, ended up living on a sailboat after a fall caused severe damage to his back. I started thinking about that I could have died from falling down those stairs and what I was going to do now. He says, after much contemplation, I concluded that I wanted to go sailing. He lived on his first boat for 2 years before undertaking the refit of a 38-foot warrior named Athena about 5 years ago. His fiancée, Eva Corrado, joined him last year. For a long time, I thought the only plan was buying a house, having a mortgage, getting a job, and that was it, she says. But now, we get to enjoy the freedom. Dalke makes enough money through his YouTube channel, Sail Life, that they can afford to cruise full-time. When we spoke, Dalke and Corrado were stuck in Spain, awaiting favorable winds to Portugal. Being at the mercy of the elements can be frustrating, but relinquishing some control is part of the allure of sailing. A motor company provides some surety if you need it to hurry into port before dark or outrun a storm, but for the most part, sailing forces you to go with the flow. Audette and his wife decided to take to the sea after the death of a son and the confines of pandemic living. We had a very materialistic life in a kind of semi-upscale town, and all was going well, but we sort of, in the back of our mind, said, you know, maybe at some point in our lives we want to go on one more adventure, one more lifestyle change, where we are not experts, where we grow and learn and adapt and re-challenge ourselves, he says. The pair, retired from lucrative but sedentary office jobs in Massachusetts, sold their house, gave away most of their possessions, and bought Angelfish. Audette invested $100,000 into the vessel above what he paid for it, but for good reason. It has to be working as well as it can be to keep you and your family afloat and alive. Indeed, when you live on a cruising sailboat, your senses become tuned to notice the slightest change. My boat is outfitted with an autopilot, which will keep it relatively on course, but isn't totally reliable. That means my wife or I must always be at the wheel looking out for the obstructions. Even when anchored or tied to a dock, we subconsciously listen through the white noise of the boat's groaning for the odd sound that might indicate trouble. Living on a boat, you start to learn to live in the present, says Audette. A couple of nights ago, our anchor dragged during a big windstorm, and I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to reset our anchor. As we were doing that, I happened to notice that the moon was a quarter full, and when I saw it earlier, it was a full moon. I realized he was witnessing a lunar eclipse. So we stayed up and watched the rest of it. You can't imagine having an experience like that if you weren't living in the moment. You develop a rhythm. Not every moment has been so beautiful, of course. Even for a couple as long and happily married as Odette and Karen, cohabitating in such a tight space took some getting used to. Our living room is also our dining room, which is right next to our kitchen, which is also right next to the bathroom, says Odette. But eventually, you develop a rhythm of working around each other. He says the boat yoga required to maintain the vessel and simply for daily life keeps them young. The boat has actually given me better health. In my previous materialistic land-based life, I had a very sedentary job where I would sit for 10 to 12 hours a day. My wife and I can relate. During those 6 months aboard the Pelican, we, along with our 22-pound dog Rackham, who's named after an 18th-century pirate, grew accustomed to the boat ballet, figuring out how to cook, clean, and even just sit and read comfortably while respecting each other's space. For now, we're weekend pirates. Pelican lives at a marina about a half hour from my house as two working journalists. We couldn't keep up with the rigors of full-time sailing or of hunting for a Wi-Fi signal in the middle of the ocean, but from my front door I can look down the street at the blue water of the Neuse River and dream of cutting lines for some good day. By the way, as we have mentioned, Dan Parsons is a freelance writer, and he now lives in New Bern. Lots of sailboats in that New Bern Oriental area, by the way. My sister happened to be a sailboat liver for a long time with her late husband, and they had a marvelous time living on a boat, and everything that I just read to you was very similar to their own experience, I can attest, because I got to crew the ship a few times when we were sailing. So there is a ballet. You have to kind of dance around each other as you go through the galley and then get to the berth if you're sleeping in the berth. And depending on where you're told you're going to toss your togs. And I always just carried one little basically a tote bag of a couple of changes, and that was it whenever I went down to be with them. They kept the boat docked at a marina in Onslow County, right near the Marine Corps base there. My late brother-in-law happened to be a retired Marine, so he was very familiar with sailing and really loved the water. And I got to love it, too, because living on a sailboat does come with some very special privileges. And my friend, that's going to bring us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. I hope you've enjoyed all these rather eclectic journeys and that you'll be joining us next time, and that reminding you that I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any questions or comments, you may call us at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.